Mr. Edwards, Reel 4. Well, after you moved to Rudston Camp in June 1943, what was the nature of Rudston Camp? Can you describe it a bit?
Yes, it was a Nissen Hut camp in a wood, a small wood, about a quarter of a mile outside the village of Rudston. It was on the road and going heading north. We were a troop to each hut. The ablutions was just a trough behind the hut with a tap, and that was where you had to wash and shave every morning out in the oven.
What about the latrines?
Latrines I don't know if they were buckets or all in the ground, but they were sort of a corrugated thing at one side. I think it was probably a hole in the ground with a wooden seats over the top.
Now, you got your Shermans while you were there. Can you give us an outline of it? Because that's a very important part of your story. What did you think of the Shermans?
Well, when we received the Shermans, I was a bit disappointed because I'd liked the Crusaders, and the Shermans didn't look anything like a tank compared with the Crusader. But we got used to them, but they were uncomfortable cross-country because they're very stiff suspension compared with a Crusader, which had a nice suspension. And they were slow. And we didn't have them very long before they had to put them all out of action while they changed the propeller shafts, because apparently propeller shafts had been breaking through revving going downhill. So they changed all the propeller shafts. They had advantages in that, number one, they had a better gun than a Crusader.
Tell me about the gun.
It was a 75mm gun. You could fire HE or armour piercing or smoke. It was a nice gun as regards...
Do you remember how exactly you loaded it and fired it?
Yes, well, the loading was... It was very easy to load because the breech butt was sideways on, so that if the open breech butt faced the loader, so you could do a rapid fire with it. It was very easy to load compared with any other gun, actually, because you could do rapid fire with it. As regards aiming and firing, it was... A periscope sight, and to my mind it wasn't a very good sight.
What was wrong with it?
Partly because the periscope didn't always fit tightly into the holder. I mean, on our tank, for instance, when we were in action in Normandy, I had to take over the gunnery because we lost one of the crew from the gunner, and I found there was a cigarette packet in the sight holding the blinking periscope tight. Well, I mean, the slightest movement in your periscope would put you a mile off aiming. So there's a sick... I thought the gun sights weren't very good.
And what else about... Where would you store your ammunition for use in the turret and lower,
Well, in the early Shermans, we had ammunition in the turret, round the turret ring, about a dozen rounds in clips around the turret ring, and others... And there were a couple of ammunition bins in the side sponsons, and then there was a big ammunition bin behind the co-driver, and he could get at those and hand them through to the turret.
So now in the you'd have the commander of your tank, and you, and a wireless operator.
Well, in this case, I was a loader and wireless operator. Pat Kettridge was a gunner. We had a commander and a driver and co-driver.
Pat Kettridge had gone to gunner
then? Yeah, we were still in the same crew and he was gunner.
Well, why did it change?
I can't remember. It was just a case of the troop leader sorted things out and that's how we came.
So you were on the wireless and loader?
Wireless and loader, yeah.
And what was it like as far as a wireless operator was concerned?
It was quite easy, yeah, quite easy.
And you had a co-driver, what did they do?
Nothing except they had a Browning machine gun which they could use, and they were just a spare driver to give the other one a spell sometimes.
So they took turns and
I never knew them take turns in the Shermans actually, but... they were there in case, or they were there to be a driver if a driver was on leave, for instance, or out of action.
And were you aware then, when you got them, of how vulnerable the the Shermans were to fire and
no.
the rest of it.
No.
Do you have any idea at all?
No, we didn't, no.
What about the height? Did that worry you?
Yes, I mean, there again, we were much higher than a Crusader, and it stuck out like a sore thumb in the countryside. That's the general impression. They were too high, they were ungainly looking, they were poor suspension, and well, not poor suspension, but very stiff suspension, which made them uncomfortable cross-country. And you were frightened of them falling over because they looked a bit top-heavy. In fact, I know one crew, the tank did fall over, and they were trapped inside it. The turret crew were trapped inside, they couldn't get out.
So, what about the sort of training you were doing at Rudston? Do you remember that?
Well, we did sort of training on the Browning machine gun, on the 75 and the Browning machine gun. Sergeant Truscott had been on a course, and he taught us about the Browning machine gun.
And what did you think of the Browning?
It was quite all right, not as good and strong as the Beezer, but we learnt all about it. We didn't know whether it was good or bad at the time, but we learnt all about it. And then when we got the full complement of Shermans, because they didn't all come at once, we started on schemes and on the Yorkshire Wolds, various schemes.
Is this things like Blackcock and Eagle?
Oh, those were later.
Oh, okay, all right, sorry.
Well, I don't remember Blackcock. I was just wondering if that was in before. I don't know. I can't remember which was called Blackcock.
So what were the schemes like?
Well, we used to go out and manoeuvre around the countryside and sleep in the bivvy. In the case of the Sherman, we used to tie the bivvy to the back of the tank. And
so it was getting you used to battle lifestyle?
Yes, I suppose so, yeah. And we used to go on lots of visits to the shooting range. We used to shoot a lot.
Which range was this? There's one at Kirkcudbright you went to, but...
Oh, that was later. We used to go to a lot in Yorkshire, on the Yorkshire moors. I don't know the names of them, but it was one at Farlingdales, on Farlingdales Moor. One near a place called... Can't remember. There were three ranges that we used to go to in the Yorkshire Moors. One of them was not far from Ripon, as I remember, and it was in valleys, and we used to fire the Beezers a lot. While the tanks were on the move, you could, with them being in a valley, you could fire on the move because the bullets didn't fly away anywhere. And also there was a Sten gun range there, and we all went round the Sten gun range with two magazines and blazing away the sort of German soldier targets all over the place behind bushes, and you dash along and you suddenly see a target and you have to blaze away these.
But what did you think of the Sten gun?
Well, a short range, all right. About 5 yards, you were all right after that.
Were you aware of the problem with them sometimes going off?
Oh, right. Not at the time, no. I learnt about that afterwards, that if you dropped it or bumped it, it could easily shoot.
So they didn't warn you about that before?
No. I found that out myself once, after the war, a long time after the war, I realised I found that out. But I had known about it beforehand, because on some of them they started putting a hole that you could push the cocking handle in to stop it jumping about. But the early ones would fire themselves if you'd bump them or drop them.
As a tank crew, that was your weapon, was it, the Sten?
No, we had the revolvers, except that the driver and co-driver had a Sten gun, and the turret crew members had a revolver. But we all had to be able to fire the Sten gun, you see.
So you were doing quite a bit on the Yorkshire Moors. You moved into Bridlington, didn't you, when the winter came? Where were you staying there?
Trinity Road, in round about October, I think it was, we moved into Bridlington, and our squadron was stationed in Trinity Road. We were in requisitioned houses, a troop to a house.
What was that like?
It was all right, quite comfortable. We had our beds with three planks and a straw mattress on the floor. Two or three to a room around the house anyway. We used all the rooms except the kitchen. And it was all right. In our house, in the bathroom, there's only one bathroom. We all had to queue up in the bathroom to have a wash and a shave in the morning. And there was a brass light fitting on the wall of the bathroom. I don't think they'd allow it these days, but anyway, if you touch just the breast light fitting, you got a tingle, and while you were queuing up for a shave, we'd touch that and get a nice tingling, like it was an early morning thrill, just touching the thing, you got a nice tingle through you, and the wetter the floor, the wetter the line of floor, the stronger the tingle you got from this thing. I mean, I wonder somebody hasn't killed herself on it, I suppose, at some time. We just thought it was a bit of fun, and got a tingle off this blinking light. We had a mess hall somewhere in the town, and we used to have to form up and march down to the mess hall, and we used to whistle an Irish tune, the Sash My Father Wore, I suppose it was the Orange Men's tune. They'd been in the regiment had been in Northern Ireland, you see, in 1940.
Did you often whistle on the march?
On this particular bit, we did. Yeah, we used to whistle going down to the mess hall.
Did you know what the significance of that song, or was it just a good tune to you?
It was just a tune, but I mean, Bods did remark that if you'd whistle this down a certain part of Northern Ireland, you'd have got done or something like that, you know. But I didn't know much about Northern Ireland at the time, anyway, because when they'd been there, things had been no bother.
What about the food when you got there? I mean, we haven't talked about the food with the uni yet. What do you reckon to it?
In the Fife and Forfar?
Yeah.
Well, the food was passable. In fact, I never mentioned the food at Catterick, but it was on the awful side. So when we got to the Fife and Forfar, I thought the food was quite good. And the first morning I walked into the mess hall, it was porridge, the first course, and this chap ladled some nice thick porridge onto my plate, and I thought, that looks nice, and he said, do you want some more? And he said, oh please, give me some more. Anyway, when I've tasted it, it was salty, and I'd never had salty porridge, but anyway, I ate it and I was glad of it, and I got used to their salty porridge, but it was nice thick porridge. But at Catterick previously, it had been watery, poor watery stuff, and this was much better. But the food was passable.
When you settled in, was there a lot of banter between the English and the Scots, good-natured banter or that, or was it just not?
I don't remember that, no. I mean, the banter I remember was that there were a couple of blokes in our troop who were in the 30s, and it was 19 and 20-year-olds. Used to call them Dad for a bit, and give them a bit of cheek, but that's all I remember. I mean, 35 were quite old to us, but I don't remember any banter between the Scots and the English. I can't remember it. I'm not saying there wasn't, but I just can't remember it.
Now, later on, you did go to Kirkcudbright. I'm not quite sure you said, I think I said
Kirkcudbright.
Tank range there. And yeah, that was quite an expedition, wasn't it? What do you remember of that?
Well, we went up a few days after Christmas. I think it was after Christmas, before the New Year, if I'm not mistaken, when we went to in 1944. Well, the end of 43 it would be, after Christmas, before the New Year came. We were there for 2 weeks. The range itself was just a sea of mud. It was about 18 inches deep in mud all over the place, with the tanks continually churning it up. We stayed in a farmhouse. Well, it had been a farmhouse. It was all tied in fairly clean inside, but when you were on guard outside, you see the rats screaming. There used to be rats screaming all over the place. During the fortnight, sometimes we were firing, sometimes we were loading ammunition. I'd spent one morning at Kirkcudbright railway sidings unloading ammunition out of a railway truck onto one of our trucks. Two of us used to swing the boxes from the bottom and give lots of big swing and let fly, and it would soar up and land on the tail of the truck. It was the only way of doing it, because it was a long way up from the bottom of the railway truck into our truck.
And what about the actual firing? Did you fire, or were you just acting as loader?
I was loader. I didn't fire there, no. I was loader.
There were some problems with the standard of gunnery. You may not know. I mean,
I gather that afterwards, but I don't know why, because they'd had plenty of practice on other ranges. But I'll tell you about loading.
Yeah.
We did exercise, moving exercises, but then one particular day we did static firing. They had a number of tanks lined up, and they're doing static firing. About, I think it was 7 rounds a gunner, and each gunner had his loader. Now, Pat Ketcher's got in, and I loaded 7 rounds for him, and he got out. And the next gunner, they said, the sergeant in charge says, this next gunner's got a loader. Will you load for him? I said, okay. So I loaded 7 rounds for him, and the same for the next one. So I loaded 3 lots of 7 rounds. Now, the tank engine wasn't running, so there was no ventilation. So I'm just in my part of the little part, and I was getting the full force of all the fumes off this gunnery. And I thought, well, it smelled nasty. But what I didn't realise was the poisonous as well. And so I got out of the tank, and about 5 or 10 minutes later, I started up with the most horrible headache, the worst headache I've ever had, and I felt terrible. And I still felt terrible, but then and the guns were banging away, and I had this headache. And they stopped for a while the truck came up with tea and sandwiches, and I had my tea and sandwiches. And then they were still carrying on firing, and I wasn't doing anything, but I had to hang about till the transport took us back. And I felt shocking. Anyway, about 4 o'clock or so, I was horribly sick. And when we did go back, I just got in bed. Everybody else went for the tea. I was terrible. I got in bed, and one of the chaps brought me a cup of tea, and I had a cup of tea and went to sleep. And I woke up next morning, and I was all right. But
you've just been poisoned then.
Well, I've been poisoned by this curriculum, yeah. But you see, when a Sherman tank engine is running, you've got good ventilation, because the engine used to draw a certain amount of air through the turret. So as a hot weather tank, it was very good, because you got very good ventilation. But when it was stopped, you got no ventilation at all. There was a little fan in the extractor fan in the ceiling, but it didn't do any good at all. If I'd have just loaded 7 rounds, I think I'd probably got a bit of a headache, and it wouldn't have been so bad. But for 3 lots of 7 rounds, I was well and truly poisoned.
And anything else about Kekubri?
Yes. One day I was told to report somewhere to get on a Cromwell tank, which was going to be an umpire's tank, because there was an exercise going on. And we went up to this exercise, and one of the tanks caught fire. One of the Shermans caught fire. Why I don't know, whether it was oil on the engine, whether it was lack of cleaning or what, I don't know, but the engine caught fire, and they were messing about with fire extinguishers, and at the finish, and they couldn't get out of the tank because it was about 18 inches deep in mud everywhere. So one other tank ran alongside, and all the crew jumped off onto the other tank, and they took them away, and the order was move at least 20 yards away from the burning tank. So we all did, and that's when I saw my first brew up Sherman. It was a terrible sight. All the ammunition started exploding and burning. It was a terrible sight. But I mean, it's the sort of sight you saw very often in Normandy.
Did that give you an inkling that they do catch fire easily, since it managed to do it itself?
Not at the time, no. I just thought the things caught fire somehow. I didn't realise that the same sort of thing happened when the shell came through. But
now, after that, you went back to Bridlington, and that's when things like Blackcock and Eagle.
Well, Eagle was April. It was February 1944.
What do you remember of that?
Well, there was snow on the ground part of the time. Part of the time, I started it off, and I think I'd been on leave, and I came back, and there wasn't a vacancy for me in a tank because I'd been on leave, so I was on a petrol truck, if I'm not mistaken, for a few days, and then there was a vacancy in the tank, and for about the last week or so I was in the tank, but there was snow on the ground, it was cold.
It was an endurance exercise, and part of it was meant to be that it was to get you used to it. Was it tough?
Fairly, not terribly tough. I mean, it was cold, but as I remember, it wasn't terribly tough. Not in our crew anyway. But it was a bit monotonous, and it seemed to last a long time.
Now, after that, I think you went to Aldershot. in March.
But by the way, we had a King's inspection in the.
Didn't know about that.
I think it was in March. The King and Queen and the two princesses were coming to inspect us, and some chaps trained up as guard of honour at the station because they were going to come by train. And we spent a week cleaning the tanks up. Oh, I'll tell you about this. We spent a week cleaning the tanks up, scrubbing all the mud off and painting the signs on, the divisional signs and everything. That's where Ron Forbes came in handy, because he was in the troop and he could do these signs a treat. On the Thursday, the King and Queen were due on Friday, and on the Thursday, our squadron was sent out to do some shooting on Sea Rangers. We came in about tea time, well, in time for tea on Thursday. The tanks were absolutely covered in mud from the Rangers, because all these places have always got muddy. So after tea, everybody turned out. We got stirrup pumps and yard brushes and buckets, and we had bucket chains from the various houses, our houses, and some of the civilians were joining in with buckets and supplying water, and there was bucket chains all the way over, and there was blokes screwing with yard brushes and blokes pumping stirrup pumps, and we worked at that till it went dark, and one tank at a time all the way up the street. All the tanks were lined up in the street, and we worked till it went dark, and of course when it went dark it was dark, because it was a blackout in progress. So we went to bed with the tanks all scrubbed and washed, and got up next morning, had to put all our best BD and everything on, went to breakfast, and when we looked at the tanks, they'd all dried, dirty, streaky, dirty. And anyway, we had to line them up on the main road after breakfast, and the side of the tank that was going to face the road where the Queen was going to drive, the King and Queen were going to drive past, we were all rubbing away with bits of cotton waste trying to smarten up the side of the tank that was going. They were going to see. But anyway, when they came, they were in the limousine, and they just drove slowly past, and we all had to stand, and the crew commander saluted as they passed, and they drove past in the limousine with an escort of household cavalry in armoured cars. That was the end of March, and then shortly after that, either end of March, at beginning of April, I can't remember exactly, we went to Aldershot, into these old barracks at Aldershot.
That'd be the Warburg barracks, I think.
I believe so, yeah.
And what were these barracks like? It was your first time in big barracks, wasn't it?
It was, yes, they were okay. They were very old-fashioned, but we were on the top deck in big barrack rooms, and underneath had been what had been stables. And we had a nice, about regards catering, by the way, the catering in Bridlington and Aldershot was in our regiment was very good. It was regimental catering, and I thought it was very good, very good. We had the mess hall down below somewhere, and we had an after canteen, and the main gates out of the barracks, just you step straight out into the middle of Aldershot, so it was very convenient if you wanted to go to the cinema or Aldershot.
Now, what was that? One thing that happened there was they were waterproofing the Shermans. I mean, they'd done some work earlier, but I mean, testing, I think, but. Do you remember how each crew did their own, didn't they?
No. In our troop, one of the sergeants, whether it was Sergeant Truscott or not, one or two sergeants in the squadron anyway had been on a course, and they came back, and they, with one or two men that they trained themselves, did the difficult part of putting the funnels on and the gun, covering the guns and things, putting the charges in. But the rest of us, the inexpert ones, we were just painting welding seams with Bostik. We had to paint all the welded seams. We were just doing that all around the tank and underneath, and everywhere you could get at a welding seam, you had to paint it with Bostik. But there was one or two sergeants in the squadron who did all the clever stuff.
And did you test it, driving through the pond?
Not as I remember.
Anything else happened at Aldershot?
Where we were at Aldershot, we didn't have anything suitable for testing, it's just as I remember. At Aldershot, nothing else happened. We didn't have any exercises, as I remember.
Were you aware D-Day was coming up, and how did you feel about it?
Well, we knew we were going to be invading France, but, we were just I and most of the others were just didn't bother. Yeah. I mean, you had that feeling that in the army that you did as you were told, and you did all this training and everything else, and whatever came along you'd have to do, if you got me.
So it wasn't a matter of you were looking forward to action or that. It was just that if it came along, that would be...
Oh, it didn't look forward to it. It just as I remember, we just sort of sort of sent fairly out about it. When it came, sort of thing. Which applied to all, more or less everything in the army. If you weren't on a scheme, you didn't worry about it or look forward to it. You just went on it and did it.
Now, had your crew steadied down by this time? You had Ketteridge undergone.
By the time at Aldershot, it did settle down, and we had Pat Ketteridge on the gun. I was a loader and wireless operator. Corporal Alistair McHattie was the commander.
Alistair?
McHattie. McHattie. McHattie was the commander. Ron Forbes was the driver, Trooper Ron Forbes. And Trooper Clifford Pember was the co-driver.
Let's go through some of these guys. How were you getting... I mean, what was Pat Ketteridge like? I would just go through them in terms.
He was compared with me, he was sort of sophisticated and well-educated and nonchalant. Nonchalant is the best I can think of. He was a Catholic, and he went to church on the Sundays regardless. But he was a potential commander, and he became a tank commander later on.
Now, your corporal, the commander of tank, Alistair McHattie, what was he like?
He was almost 6 feet, heavily built, about 14 or 15 stone, 15 stone, I would say. He was blonde and had a blonde moustache, a big rosy face, and he was an ex-policeman from Hamilton, Scotland.
Nice chap?
Yes, very nice.
And Ron Forbes. Now I know Ron Forbes, but I knew Ron when he was 80. What was he like as a young lad?
He was at the time he was mid 20s, I think probably about mid 25 or 26 mark, and he was Italian looking, because he was very dark, slim and dark, very dark looking, but he was all right, and we got on okay. And Clifford Pember was a Welsh, and we called him Taffy. Don't call him Taffy now, but we called him Taffy then. He was about my size, about 5'8", and slim and blonde. Very upright he was.
And you all got on well?
We got on very well, yeah.
And that was the crew you went to war with?
That's the one we went across on, yeah.
Now, the next thing, do you remember, were you at Aldershot when D-Day came, or had you moved to Gosport?
No,
I'm not quite sure.
We were at Aldershot. I was on the main gate guard starting at 6 a.m. and I went to the main gate at 6 a.m. to start my day guard, and a Spitfire flew over it, had black and white stripes on the wings, and I thought, that means something, and D-Day had arrived. And we were still there for about, well, later that day, we had one of the cells full of maps, and later that day we had all these maps to sort out, and we were sorting maps out and marking them ready for going over.
And you could see then it was
Normandy. Well, we knew it was Normandy because they'd actually landed that night. Well, they'd landed in the night actually. Oh, and that same day in the evening it was raining. And a whole fleet of an armada of planes flew over the top. It was sort of one of the second or third wave of the 6th Airborne Division taking the heavy equipment. All these planes, towing gliders, were scores of planes. There were Halifaxes and Albemarles and Dakotas, all towing gliders over to take them over to Normandy. It was the heavy equipment for the 6th Airborne Division. That was in the evening.